a song and let the beat rock.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to Ear to the Ground, a feature news program reported and produced at irregular intervals by the fine volunteers at KGVM. I'm your host, Rachel Leith, and you are listening to KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. That know me best, I feel like me and Taylor might still have spawned myself sad looking. That's why I made that shit famous. Goddamn! I made that shit famous. It has been said that if you live in Bozeman long enough, you're bound to get your 15 minutes of fame at least once. But there are some folks whose names come up again and again. Community leaders, conversation starters, legends. We're calling this episode of Ear to the Ground, Bozeman Famous. We'll meet some of Gallatin Valley's most recognizable voices, starting with reporter Devin Wilson's interview with local gearhead legend Bob Strenwick. Born and bred in Gallatin Valley, Bob's obsession with automobiles stretches over a lifetime. From hot rods to drag racing, Bob's done it all.
The story of the hot rod race that fatal day when the Ford and the Mercury.
The American car enthusiast. You may have met one or even know one yourself. This handy, ingenious individual might be found at local car shows and out and about for a summer cruise in their cars. Each one as specialized and unique as the person who built them. These labors of love required time, love, and blood from many a busted knuckle. Oftentimes, the love of cars are a window into the person's past, a standing physical embodiment of times long gone. The enthusiast forges and customizes their creation for the love of building some functioning, drivable piece of art that is as much a part of their lives as it is history. These inventive creators start with the cars and soon form friendships with other compatriots, lifelong relationships that lead to connections, clubs, shows, and furthered interest in the world of custom automobiles. Bob Strenwick is such an individual. His shop is filled with cars. Machines to fabricate the parts he needs for his custom work, and memorabilia from days past and days when there was a drag strip by the Bozeman Airport. He grew up in the area and has seen more in his time here than most residents in this valley.
Okay, in 1955, I was 9 years old, and I was born a car kid. I was just infatuated by all cars and pickups. So my dad, who was not necessarily a car guy, but he knew I had an interest in it, he took me to the local Chevy dealer, which back then was called Northern Auto, based out of Main Street, and we went there for the grand presentation of the new 55 Chevy cars. And they made their presentation because they had a cover on them, and when everybody got there, they took the cover off, and everybody went, ooh, and ah. And I did, too. Because it was such a radical difference from the previous Chevys. So, the pickup line, they didn't bring that out until later in the year, which would have been around October, as I recall. Now, they didn't do a presentation for the pickups, but one of our local businessmen that had a construction company close to North 7th, he bought one. And I was walking to school from my house to the school, and Haggerty Mesmer Construction was right in between. And I knew who the owner was, and it was Jimmy Mesmer, and he just bought a new 55 Chevy pickup custom cab. And that was being the first one I ever saw. I was astounded by how beautiful the lines were on it and everything. So I said to myself right then that someday I was going to have one that looked exactly like that. As the years went by, which was about 20 years, I started dabbling in 55 to 57 Chevy pickups. And I had several of them, but they weren't exactly what I saw. So I did find this body in Bozeman, way up on North or South 19th, I got it home, and I started working on it, and I was sanding the doors, and there it was, Haggerty Mesmer Construction written on the doors. So I said, that's impossible.
The same one, the first one.
The same one, the same one. And so that really gave me adrenaline to getting it done. And we really did it as a family project. My two sons helped me, and my wife was involved in it. We got it done, and we've enjoyed it ever since.
It's hard to represent how beautiful these are on the radio.
It is. It really is. Yeah. Yeah, it is too bad. The only thing that they can do is I've got the Hot Rod Lincoln. You just Google Stretchers Hot Rod Lincoln, and that comes up. And that's the article that was in Hot Rod.
How did you get into hot rodding?
My brother was 7 years older than me, and he started collecting car magazines, hot rod magazines. And I was about 9 years old, and for lack of anything better to do, I just started reading his magazines. And it just sucked me in how some of these young guys that really didn't have any money could create these hot rods and drive them. I mean, they were just taking junk and putting it together. Mm-hmm. And I was just amazed how you could do that. So I was too young to do it, but I was always interested in it. And then when I was in high school, I was in shop class, and I excelled at that because I really loved putting metal together, what you could build out of. I was fascinated by it. And so as soon as I could, I got my driver's license. I was into building cars. My first one was a 54 Chevy, and I fixed it up a little bit, and I kind of learned kind of how to approach it. And then I bought an old Model T out in the sticks, and I started building a frame for it, not knowing what I was doing, but I was learning. A lot of mistakes, but you learn from your mistakes. Mm-hmm. You make a better deal out of it. In fact, I didn't have the Model T done until I was going to college. I had to get married. So Model T had to go away. At the same time, my cousin that lived in eastern Montana was doing the same thing, building a 1927 Model T. And same thing, it was rather crude, but he got it to the point that he could drive it. And we'd ride around in it several times when I'd go down to visit him. And I got a real love to have another Model T back. So as the years went by, he parked the Model T behind the garage and walked away from it. And a few years later, I approached him and I said, "Well, since you're not doing anything with this Model T," I said, "can I buy it?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I'd like you to have it." And he says, "You're not buying them." He says, "I'm giving it to you." So that is the Model T that's over in the corner. So I did that one after I got it from him. I changed everything, and I did it exactly the way I wanted to do the first one that I had. So I'll turn the story to that.
Wow.
And then it's just been a progression. And through life, you have to... you have to do other things, like buy a house and start a business and raise kids. So I took a little bit of recess from it, but I never did lose my love for the hobby. And then once the kids were older and the house was paid for, then I went right back to doing what I enjoyed doing, building cars.
Awesome.
Yeah.
In high schools today, there's no shop classes anymore.
I know that. The reason for that is that us parents wanted to have our kids have an easier life than we did. I mean, I wanted my two sons to go to college and do something better than working with your hands. Mm. So that is the reason that we don't have a lot of workers today, because everybody is like computer oriented, but they don't work with their hands. Mm. And it's nothing to be ashamed about. It's just that I feel that my generation has ruined the younger generation, because we wanted the kids to have a better life, mm. You know, and that's why we're at today. Just even in our business, you know, it's a fun business. It's a great trade, and the welding field is so huge that you can go a lot of different directions. I mean, I know some younger kids that work for NASA and. Our aeronautical engineers and everything, they learned that trade just from building hot rods.
That's awesome. You've been
in the area for so long. And
I was born and raised here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Been drag racing since the drag strip was down there.
All of it, yeah.
Yeah. You want to tell us about the drag strip?
Well, okay. The interesting story is that in 1958, they were having problems with kids drag racing. After they finished their hot rods, they wanted to drag race. And, of course, that meant on the streets and the highways.
Mm.
Well, that was very unsafe, and everybody knew that. So in 1958, the Highway Patrol closed down Jackrabbit Lane over here.
Mm.
And it had two lanes. And they stopped at one end, and they stopped at the other. And the kids lined up to do their drag racing, which was, you know, it wasn't really safety-oriented, but it was a whole lot better than racing on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So they did that. Well, they had such a participation that the next year, the Pacers, the Bozeman Pacers car club, organized a drag strip at Belgrade. They got permission from the FAA at the airport board to have it on an abandoned airstrip. And so that went for until 1965, where the FAA banned all drag racing in the airport. Mm. Yeah, so that was really an interesting era to live through, because it gave the kids incentive to improve their cars, to make them safer at speed, and of course be competitive. It was fun because our hangouts were not necessarily drive-ins. They were the gas stations that you could get permission to work on the car. They at least get your car in on the hoist and raise it up and tinker on it.
Awesome.
So back in those days, some of the gas station owners in after hours would allow kids to come in and work on the cars.
Bunch of grease monkeys.
That's right. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And that's kind of where we learn, you know, because when you look at a car, you're blown away by how many parts there are.
Mm-hmm.
But if you focus yourself on each part, and if you're like rebuilding it, just use that as a goal to get that particular part done that day. And then after you get that done, you go on to the next part. You just keep on doing that until all of a sudden, poof, you're done.
Kind of like life.
It is. It's the same thing as life. It really is. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Totally.
That's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, the stories is just what makes it really, really interesting. You know, there's just so many of them. And I've cared so much what happened in those days because it was really a positive influence, you know, to the valley. A lot of history. And like I say, from those days, guys have gone different directions, but they always remember those days, you know, cruising the drag in their hot rods and hanging out at the gas station. I got an interesting picture. You got to check this out, man. And this is exactly the way it was. That reminds me so much of those days that you combine the IQ of those guys and you still get about a one. But we didn't care. We were involved in it. And maybe whichever the owner was, you know, he's doing his stuff, but all of his buddies are there helping him. And that's what it was, a tight bond. You know, it really was a bond. I look at that and I laugh because that's exactly as it was.
You think that young people these days need to get back into hot rod and motorheads?
I would love to see it. Yeah. I would love to see it because, like I say, it combines friendship, it combines learning. I just can't imagine living my life without it, what I would have done, you know? I'd probably be in prison by now.
What would you recommend to a young listener, what they need to do to get going?
Culminate all the knowledge you can about a car. And it doesn't, I mean, even if it's a present-day car, which is state-of-the-art, I don't even know how much further these cars can go. I mean, everybody's going to need transportation to get from point A to point B, but knowing how what's getting you there and just learning about it. And also, there's a lot of books and literature about building a car. I mean, you can Google almost anything anymore. I'm not saying this new high-tech stuff is bad. I think it's excellent, but just remember that it's a tool that you can use to do research or, you know, pinpoint a problem you're having with your car or your truck or something. I mean, I wish we would have had those a long time ago. It would have sped up our learning ability, you know, that you could get an answer. Back then, the only way we could get an answer was trying to befriend an old mechanic or an old machinist to get information off of him that you can apply to your problem. So that was kind of a twofold thing, is that you had to learn social skills to learn how to get along with the old timers, because basically they didn't want to deal with a young kid, probably a smart ass. And but it taught you kind of social things of how you get this information.
Bob has lived an exciting life that began with his love of cars and culminated in lifelong friendships and a wealth of knowledge about one of the loves of his life, the automobile. And maybe, if you're lucky, you might meet him at some local or national car show relaxing with his friends. And you can be assured that he has some stories to tell.
Corner with the tires on the side, you could feel the tension. Man, what a ride. I said, hold on, I got a license to fly, when that Cadillac pulled over and let me go by. And all of a sudden, the rod started knocking, went down in a dip, and she started rocking. I looked in my mirror, and a red light was blinking. The cops was after my hot rod Lincoln. And put me in jail. I called my pop to go my bail. He said, son, you're gonna drive it a drinking. You don't quit driving that hot rod Lincoln.
Shifting gears to another local legend, next we'll hear an interview I did with self-described community rabbi Ed Staffman, whose tremendous influence on Gallatin Valley in the 10 years he's been here is nothing short of miraculous.
I'm a rabbi. Well, actually, as of a month ago, I'm retired, but from the congregation, but I'm still a rabbi. And my name is Ed Staffman. Well, I was born actually in Key West, Florida, when my dad was in the Navy. I have very few memories of that, except how green the sea was. And then we moved to New York City, to Brooklyn, where we grew up in a rather poor neighborhood, lower middle class. In an apartment building, a small apartment building. I'd say I had a rather unremarkable childhood. As far as my Jewish life, I was raised in a secular Jewish world. In other words, culturally Jewish, but not religious or spiritual in any way. I went to high school at Brooklyn Technical High School. And then I went to undergraduate school after that at State University of New York at Stony Brook on Long Island, which was during the time of the Vietnam War. It was largely the Vietnam War that I think changed lots of people's consciousness at that time. It was the first time that we understood that our government was lying to us about things, about, like, for example, that, you know, that we weren't in Cambodia when it turns out we were, or the horrors that went on during that war. I guess what developed in me is, and it really came from my Jewish roots, but I didn't know it at the time, was a strong calling to do justice work. And so I went to law school. I had wanted to come to the Northwest because I'd seen it in movies and I thought it was so beautiful. So I applied to law schools in the Northwest only and got accepted at several. And I ended up going my first year to Gonzaga in Spokane. It wasn't exactly the Northwest that I had envisioned. It was turned out to be quite conservative and not so not the beautiful mountains that I thought would be here. Anyway, I spent a year there, and then I won a scholarship to attend the World Academy of International Law in The Hague, Netherlands, where I went for one semester. because I was very much interested in international law, but lost interest after that semester, ran out of money. In the interim, my parents had moved to Florida, and so I had in-state residence there, technically, and I transferred and finished law school at Florida State University in Tallahassee. But I had done some major trips abroad, and I had decided that what I wanted to do indefinitely was become a world traveler. And so when I graduated law school in 1977, I set a goal of living as a student, in other words, cheaply. I was a young lawyer, and I saved all my money, and I set a date of June 1st, 1980, 3 years hence, where I would take off on my travels. Sold everything I had, bought some quality backpacking equipment and a tent and whatnot at REI. And everything I owned was on my back. And I spent the next 20 months in South America, first learning Spanish and then making my way down from Mexico to Tierra del Fuego in the southern tip, and then back up through the mountains. It wasn't so much about where, but the nature of traveling was such that you were totally free and unencumbered. So that when I woke up in the morning, very often I wasn't sure who I would meet that day, where I would spend the next night, how far I'd get. Sometimes so along the way, I picked up a friend. I met a woman who adopted my goals, and we were traveling together through most of that trip. We met so many interesting people. Sometimes we walked, hiked, and sometimes we hitchhiked. Sometimes we took buses. Once we took a plane over the Darien Gap because it's not really safe to travel there. But it was the thrill of total freedom. The only thing that obligated us was the backpack and, you know, the washing of our clothes periodically, finding food to eat, a place to spend the night, which if we didn't find a place, we always had the tent. And even if we were in a city, there'd usually be an abandoned lot somewhere where we could set up the tent. The choice to go to South America first was because we intended to go on throughout the entire world. But the choice to go to South America was because we wanted to live off of our savings, and South America was the least expensive place. And so we could pretty much live off the interest on the, at that time, not a lot of money that we saved. We were living on a few dollars a day. There's a verse in the Psalms that says, "Teach us to treasure each day, that we may open our hearts to your wisdom. Teach us to treasure each day." Every day was so full. There were no routine days that had nothing to them. Oh, maybe occasionally, but not very often. I remember, for example, I kept a book at the time, a diary of what I called mind-blowing experiences. And I literally, in the course of 20 months, had dozens. For example, we were hiking in Torres del Paine National Park in the south of Chile. At that time, it was relatively unknown. Now it's pretty popular, but they had only just recently introduced the last dozen Andean condors in the world back into that area. They were almost extinct. And we were on a mountain pass, and all 12 of them came circled above us and actually got close enough to scare us. But to see the last remaining 12 Andean condors in the world, all flying just a few feet above you, was, I'd call it mind-blowing. To sit with a musician who had lost his fingers for, that were chopped off by the government in Chile because he was playing protest songs in the stadium where all the political prisoners were kept during the government of Pinochet, was just so invigorating and so to be so alive. And it was just one after another of experiences like that. There were many hardships too, but we tend to forget that. But every day was so rich. And of course, most of us live our lives and every day is not so rich. So it taught me to at least strive to make every day rich, and, or not to make it rich, to recognize the richness in every day. At that time, you know, I needed incredible things to remind me. But after that, I learned that, you know, just walking in a desert that seems to be empty can be just as rich. It's just a question of what you're attuned to. So I think that was maybe the main lesson I learned from that. It was really a very foundational experience for me in that way. And the intention was to go on to Asia next, but my traveling partner's father had gotten sick and we came back to kind of help him. And then one thing led to the next, and didn't get back on the road. And then I met my wife, and that wasn't really part of her. I ended up taking a job, and shortly thereafter, opening my own law office. That was in Tallahassee, Florida, and where I'd gone to law school. And so for about 25 years, I practiced law. And I started out as basically doing whatever came in the door. Little small criminal cases, divorces, whatever. But also what my passion was for civil rights work. And the problem was that civil rights work didn't pay very well and was long and drawn out. So when it did pay, it might take 2 to 5 years before you saw any pay. And so those sort of routine cases kept me going. A few years into my practice, maybe, I guess it was probably the mid-80s towards the late-80s, I got a visit from this woman. Her name is Charlotte Holdman. She passed away this year. She was actually the feature of This American Life episode. And she was Time Magazine called her the mistress of delay. And she was not a lawyer, but she was passionate about the death penalty. And what she would do is find lawyers for guys who were on death row who were about to be executed. And Charlotte managed to talk me into volunteering to do a case for a guy who was to be executed a week or two after that. The man's name was Anthony Ray Peek. And he was on death row in Florida. And long story short, I quickly discovered that there was something very strange in his conviction, that he was convicted based on hair evidence, that an expert testified that a hair found at the scene matched his, and that such a match would only happen in one out of several hundred thousand cases. And that didn't seem right to me. And I did the research and found out that that was nonsense. And then I located the expert who had since been fired and who told me that they pressured her into saying that. Anyway, we got a new trial. It's a kind of a long saga, but at the end, he was found not guilty. That kind of drove me into doing a lot of death penalty work. And in the course of the next 20 years, I did probably involved in a couple of hundred death penalty cases, sometimes as lead counsel, sometimes assisting other lawyers. For a while, myself and a colleague started what was called the Volunteer Lawyers Research Center, which was federally funded. And we basically would, when lawyers from other states would come and volunteer to represent these guys, we would be resourced to them. So familiarize them with the law and the courts and so on in Florida. I was adamantly opposed to the death penalty, most of which was had to do with just how arbitrary it was. There was a joke at the time. We used to say capital punishment means he with the capital don't get the punishment. And I would tell people, and it was 99% true, if you had enough money, we could avoid the death penalty. in any case. There are exceptions, rare exceptions, but that's so. I mean, as an example, I once had a case where there were three guys, three defendants, and it was maybe the worst crime I'd ever seen in terms of these guys just got out of prison. They were drug users, and they raped and murdered a woman and her husband, burned down the house. It just doesn't get much worse than this. And they were all about equally culpable. Each one was entitled to a court-appointed lawyer, and mostly I was doing private work, but I did some court-appointed things now and again. And each one got a lawyer off of the list, what's called the conflict list. And the lawyer you got was a function of alphabetical order. And so I got assigned to one of the three guys, and the other two got other lawyers. And it was a very difficult case. What the desired outcome from the defense point of view was life in prison. That's a win in that case. But eventually the prosecutor came to me and said he wanted to offer my guy a deal of life in prison in exchange for testifying against the other two. In other words, you win if you'll testify against the other two. Well, my client decided to take the deal. After it was all over, I asked the prosecutor why he made my guy the deal. Well, of the three, he could have done it with any of them. And he said, because I was making the most trouble for him in the case, and he wanted me off the case. And my point is that my guy got the deal because of alphabetically where the lawyer list came up. And he got life in prison. The other two guys both got death. But it's just an example of how arbitrary the system is. And there's 100 other arbitrary factors in every case, some of which has to do with race of the jury, who are the police officers involved, who are the judges involved, et cetera, et cetera. And it's as if you take 1,000 murder cases and pick two or three people who will execute, and they're randomly plucked from the potential people. So that kind of arbitrariness really bothered me, along with the sense that we're not God. And it's one thing to put somebody in prison. It's another thing to take their life. We don't know who's worthy of living and who's not. Remember that the overwhelming majority of people who commit murder get long prison sentences, maybe even life. So it's not like we're saying there should be no punishment, but picking out those handful for the death penalty seems like it's something that's really beyond human ability. And occasionally there's an innocent person among them. We know that because of, especially now in the DNA age, how many guys have ended up being freed. Even if you're guilty, there are decisions made about who deserves to live and who deserves to die. Those kind of decisions are really beyond human ability, I think. So I was very involved in death penalty stuff. I was involved with the ACLU. I was chair of the legal panel of the ACLU for a while. So I still had a hand in the civil rights cases. But I became more and more a criminal defense lawyer, less and less a civil rights lawyer. I still did some civil rights, but the law on civil rights was always changing during this time and always getting more hostile to the person who was asserting civil rights violations. So that in Tallahassee, when I started practice, there were a dozen firms doing civil rights. And when I left, there were maybe two or three, because the cases, the law has so constricted and it was so much harder to win. So I had moved over. I still occasionally would do one, but mostly I moved over to death penalty. And I did other things too. I was played a big role in the 2000 election contest between Gore and Bush. There were four main cases. Now people only know the case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, Bush v. Gore, but there was three other important cases, and I was lead counsel on one of them. I had about 10 lawyers working for me who'd flown in from all over the country. And we thought at the time most people thought that our case had the best chance of success. But it's complicated, and we lost. Basically, the networks all called the case for based on polling, post-election polls. In other words, where they interview people coming out of the voting booths. They called it for Gore early on. And those polls are almost never wrong, because unlike polls that say, who are you going to vote for? These are people who already voted and know who they voted for. And then later on that night, suddenly they took back the call. The networks did. And it became very close. And ultimately it was just a few hundred votes in a out of millions, that separated them. And there were a number of irregularities. The biggest one, at least in terms of popular knowledge, was in Dade County in Miami area, where they used ballots that had these punch cards. And sometimes you'd punch the hole in the card, but it wouldn't be a clean punch. And the Florida courts had ruled you have to go back and look at each card to discern if it's not a clean punch. Can you clearly make out the voter's intent? And the Republicans managed to stop the recount. And the question in that case would be whether there had to be a recount that went back and looked at each individual ballot. It started again and stopped again and started. And ultimately, it stopped. And they weren't allowed to do the recount. The Florida Supreme Court was insistent that every vote must count. And you must determine the intention of the voter, even if there's an irregularity because the punch didn't go all the way through or something like that. And that's the case that's best known. And basically, at the end of the day, at a 5-4 vote, the United States Supreme Court stopped the count. But there were three other lesser known cases. I mean, they were at the time, they were equally known, but because the way history played out, they were lesser known. And one was mine. Where what happened was Jeb Bush was the governor at the time, Bush's brother. And he had arranged for a change in the absentee ballot law so that you no longer had to be absent from the state to vote absentee ballot. Anybody could do it. You just had to go down and fill out an application, and they'd send you an absentee ballot, and you can vote. And after they changed that law, at the same time, they put in a lot of provisions to prevent fraud. So when you filled out your application, you had to have it just right. You had to have all the information just right. It had to be signed just right, et cetera. And then the Republican Party went and hired this firm in Texas to pre-print absentee ballot request forms in two counties that were highly Republican. So if you lived in those counties and you were a Republican, you would get a card. And you'd get a letter from Jeb Bush, which said, you may now vote absentee ballot. You don't have to go to the polls anymore. All you have to do, we're filling out your application for you. All you have to do is sign it, send it back, and you'll get an absentee ballot before the election. And then you can vote by mail. And, you know, this was, a change, but it was good politics. It was clever and, nothing illegal or anything about it. Only thing was that the company in Texas that created the forms had a bug in their computer program, and the information on the cards was all wrong. So you might get a card that had your name on it, but your voter ID number was wrong and your address was wrong and everything else. And if you didn't look at it closely, you'd just sign it and send it back. And it was because of the voter fraud protections. If the supervisor of elections would have in fact issued you a ballot based on an incorrect card, it would have been a felony for her to do so. But the supervisor of elections was a Republican, and she started to receive these cards, and she realized immediately that, she can't issue an absentee ballot based on these cards. And so, what she did, was call the head of the Republican Party in those counties, who said, I'll be right over. And he came and he took all the cards back to Republican headquarters. And he started crossing out the information and putting in correct information by hand, him and his staff. But the cards had already been signed by the people saying this is certified to be true and correct, and they were already public records. You just can't go down to the courthouse and take public records out and change them and then bring them back. And so those people that were issued absentee ballots and they voted, and we were able to prove that had it not been for that, had you eliminated all those votes, Gore would have won the election. But our argument was that, in fact, the votes did reflect the intent of the voters. There was a technical irregularity. So we argued that, essentially, that was in fact fraudulent votes, and you can't count them. The court agreed with us that they were fraudulent votes, and that the supervisor of elections committed hundreds of felonies, although she was never prosecuted for them. However, they said that law is that you have to ascertain the voter's intention. And that was, in fact, the voters did vote as they intended, even if there was a technical irregularity, even fraud. Because the voters didn't commit fraud. Most of them didn't realize that the information was bad. So in a way, we were arguing the opposite of what they argued in the famous Bush v. Gore case, right, where they said every vote must count, even if there's an irregularity. And we figured if we won either case, we'd win the election. But the Supreme Court took their case and not ours. And so our case died in the Florida courts with saying, who said irregularities, voter intent supersedes irregularities. But their case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which basically stopped the recount, in my view, based on it was just a totally political decision. And so that was actually the last case I tried before I retired from law. Yeah, you know, it wasn't so much that I retired as much as in many ways I was at the top of my game, but I stumbled upon something else I'd rather be doing. And that was it. It wasn't that there was anything wrong with what I was doing or that I was unhappy in any way. And as I said earlier, you know, at that time I was still more or less a secular Jew. My spiritual life was fairly limited. I could say that now. I don't know what I would have said then. And there was this woman who I knew who was always trying to convince me to go to the spiritual retreats that she went to. And she just had a sense that I would like them. And I would essentially listen to her and then walk away and roll my eyes that I didn't have time for that kind of woo-woo thing. Then one time she approached me, and it so happened that the following week I had a trial scheduled that had settled that day. And so I had a week open on my calendar, and there was going to be this spiritual retreat that next week. And she just hit me at a moment that I didn't have a reason to say no thanks. And so I decided to go. And I found it to be a life-changing experience. You might call it a heart-opening experience, where I just sensed, you know, there's a certain amount of calling back those travel experiences, that openness, that open-heartedness, that in the busy world of law and raising children and all the roles I played in the community at that time, so that I drifted away from. And being with people who were on a spiritual quest and had these fantastic teachers just opened my heart to new possibilities that I never imagined. And it was also part of what's called the Jewish Renewal Movement. And I never knew that it existed. And it was a whole new approach to Judaism, or so it seemed to me, that wasn't at all cultural, or not certainly not strictly cultural, and that was very spiritually based and mystically based. And I came home from that week, and I was in tears. And I remember telling my wife that I experienced God for the first time that week. It was at the end of the week, and there was a closing ceremony. There were a couple of hundred people there at the retreat. And during the course of the week, you got to meet 20 or 30, but certainly not all of them. And you meet people during meals and things like that. And the closing ceremony consisted of two concentric circles, with the inner circle facing out and the outer circle facing in. And so you were always facing somebody. And there was a sort of a chant, a one-line chant. I don't recall exactly what it was, that encompassed the idea of saying goodbye. And so you would look into the eyes of whoever was opposite you, and you'd both recite this chant. And then one of the circles would rotate, and you'd kind of go around and say goodbye to a lot of people that way. And there was this woman who was opposite me. And it was somebody who I had not met that week or spoken with, a total stranger for all practical purposes. And when I looked into her eyes, because part of the exercise was looking deeply into the eyes of another, which is something we don't do very often, right? It's kind of like, whoa, that's creepy. But you needed to look into the eyes, deeply into the eyes of this total stranger. And when I looked into her eyes, I saw God. I can't describe physically or visually what that was. I just knew it. But I attribute it in large part to the week worth of work, spiritual work that we'd done that week, which consisted of chanting and meditation and learning and so on, that opened my heart in a way to enable me to be in that place. If I saw that woman on the street today, I wouldn't recognize her. I have no idea who it was. But that was the first time. And I began to doubt that after I got home. I began to doubt that it was real, that it felt like, I mean, a few days later, it felt like as if, well, perhaps I just got caught up in some kind of emotional experience. And that's why I had to go back to know. And every time I'd go back, something completely different would happen. But it would be the same kind of experience of having a deep sense of God energy. At that time, the rabbinic students in the program would sometimes meet during these spiritual retreats, and they'd have their own programming and stuff, but they'd be there. And so I started to meet some of the rabbinic students. And eventually they put me down on the list of prospective students. This started in the late 90s, so that the Bush v. Gore case was in 2000. So this would have been started probably in 1997 or so. And I use that case because it was after that case that I started to wind down my practice. I mean, I started to go more and more into this as the rabbi thing as a full-time thing. And so I started flirting with the idea of, you know, could I do this? Can I make this a full-time thing? I mean, what a great thing to be able to live in this world of God all the time. And so I'd start attending, like, occasionally they'd let you take a class that the rabbinic students were taking, like audit it kind of thing. And I took it, I was way over my head at the time, but I became so enthralled with, so as I went on, it became much deeper than simply these highs. And I discovered that there was an incredible amount of wisdom, you know, 3,000 years of wisdom that had been developed, and it was a whole world I didn't know. And I realized I had an opportunity to teach that to others. I mean, at first I have to learn it myself, but I was learning more and more of it, and I just couldn't get it fast enough. And then there came a time, so I was the dean of the program, Rabbi Moshe Prager, knew that I was, she considered me a prospective student, and I'd been flirting with the idea, but I didn't really have the guts, to tell you the truth, to just go cold turkey on a successful law practice. So one day, they also at that time were, they'd hold these administrative meetings where she would discuss with the students changes in the curriculum and other administrative matters that were, you know, fairly boring, but that prospective students were allowed to attend these meetings so that you'd know what's going on with the program. And I was at one of those meetings, and she happened to announce that 6 months hence would be a ceremony for admitting new students. And I asked her afterwards, I went up to her and asked her and said, look, if I go home and get my application in that 6 months, is there time to review it? Could I be admitted then in 6 months hence if I was accepted? And she said, I wasn't really intending to do it. I just kind of wanted to know. And I was flirting, right? And she said, sit down. And I sat down. She says, look, I've known you for a couple of 3 years now. I know exactly what will be on that application. If you tell me you'll go home and get in the application, we'll admit you as a new student starting tomorrow, which is really the next ceremony. Even though there was one that's going to be, everybody knew when she said there's one in 6 months, everybody knew there was one tomorrow. And I said, oh my God, I was just flirting, and like, now you like want to make it real. And, I said, I'll think about it overnight. And so I called my wife. At that time it was a payphone. I had to wait in line to use the phone. I remember that. And I told her what had happened about the conversation with the dean. And my goal was to convince my wife to tell me, no, don't do this. And then I'd have an excuse. I wanted her to say, look, you're at the top of your law career. You know, we have a good life here, blah, blah, blah. I don't want you to go off to do something crazy. Plus, my wife is not Jewish. I'm one of just two or three intermarried rabbis in the world. Although she's participated in raising our kids Jewish and participated in the life of the Jewish community, but she's chosen not to convert. But no matter what I did, she wouldn't tell me no. So that was cornered. And I had to change my strategy by saying, yes, I'll do it, knowing that, hey, this, except for a few hundred dollars application fee, I can always drop out. Over the next couple of 3 years, I was part-time student. And as I stopped taking new case, or at least new bigger cases, and began the wind down process of my law practice, it felt like I was on the right path. I was really excited about it. At the time, I wasn't really interested in being a congregational rabbi. I thought I would do some, it'd be an extension of my civil rights work. But with a spiritual base. I didn't know how it would play out, but And I love the learning. I just love the learning. And I love the learning how to pray and praying. And I love the everything about it. And it took me, it's normally a 5-year program if you're full time. It took me 8 because I wasn't full time at first. And so from 2000 to 2008, that was my life. Along the way, I had a student pulpit in Ajijic, Mexico. And that got me interested in being a congregational rabbi, which until that point I wasn't so interested in. So in any event, when I finished in the summer of 2008, although I was 6 months shy of ordination, one day on the rabbi's listserv, there was an ad that said, Outside Magazine says that Bozeman, Montana is the number one place to live in the United States, and we're looking for a rabbi. I remember the moment distinctly because I was in my office and my wife was in her office on the other end of the house. And I screamed across the house, "Hey, what do you think about living in Bozeman, Montana?" And Beth said, "Whatever, this is another one of your harebrained ideas." We'd never been to Montana. And so I ended up applying. But I wasn't in a position to move because my son had one more year of high school. And there were other things going on in our lives that we would need a year to move. And so I proposed a deal where I'd come 10 days a month. And it could be kind of a honeymoon and we could see if we like one another. And if I like Bozeman, and if so, and besides, I wasn't ordained, so technically I'd be a student rabbi for that first 6 months. And if it worked out, that the following year we'd move. A year later, my son finished high school. My daughter finished undergrad school. Beth, who had been back at school at the time also, was a couple of courses shy of her degree in art, which they allowed her to finish up here at MSU. And so our entire family was sort of the class of 2009 in one way or another. We rented a moving truck and packed up our stuff. I remember crossing the line from South Dakota into Montana and driving across eastern Montana for the first time. And coming from Florida, what I noticed is just how high we are here in Montana. It felt like being on top of the world, starting a new life at age 53, a new endeavor, a new place. So excited about teaching everything I'd been learning that last 8 years and sharing it here. And we landed in Bozeman.
Hey guys, you're listening to KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. Right now we have an episode of Ear to the Ground playing. We're about halfway through an interview done with Rabbi Ed in August of 2018. Here's the second half of the interview.
This segment of programming is underwritten by the Sacagawea Audubon, making the Gallatin Valley a better place for birds. You can check us out at SacagaweaAudubon.org.
When I first moved here, so I'm the first resident rabbi. You know, one of the things I'd hear all the time was, "Oh, there are Jews in Bozeman? Or is there a synagogue there?" And it seemed like an anomaly at the time. You know, as I mentioned at the start, I retired from the congregation just a month ago. And I'd say probably the most enduring part of my legacy will be putting Judaism on the map within the interfaith world. I don't mean in a that asserts any kind of superiority or anything like that. Simply that as a player in ideas alongside my colleagues and various Christian churches and in the Muslim community, Buddhist community, we've built together a really strong interfaith community that has one another's backs, You know, at our Passover Seder here at my home this past year, for example, Rahul and Shabmani and Admin, the leaders of the Muslim community, were my guests. This interfaith panel, which your radio station is going to be broadcasting, was something we began. It started off as four clergy coming together to discuss an issue each month, and maybe 20 people showing up, if that. And now there's usually 100 or more people. In any number of other ways, Judaism has become a player. Oh, we have a monthly column in the Chronicle. I've done several presentations at Pachakachas, and I've done the invocation for the legislature several times. You know, I was active in organizing the religious communities to support the non-discrimination ordinance when it came up before the city. And when white supremacists showed up, I've been active in terms of formulating a community response. So a big part of my job has been being what I'd call loosely the community rabbi. And even when it comes to pastoral work, there's a surprising number of people who are not affiliated with the synagogue, sometimes Jewish, sometimes not, who end up seeking me out for various types of pastoral work, a new cancer diagnosis. Most recently, it's been people who've done DNA testing and found out that they have Jewish roots, and they want to know, what does that mean? Those are just some of the examples of things I've been involved with that, if I have a legacy at all, I think those will be those pieces. Perhaps the hardest thing I have to do is funerals for people who I really love. I'd say that's true for every clergy, though, not specific to rabbis. So on the one hand, you're grieving like any other mourner. On the other hand, you have to be the support for their family and friends and community and be strong, even though you may be personally grieving. Being a rabbi is not particularly unique in Bozeman as compared to other clergy. We all face more or less the same kind of things. The only real difference is these days in the Protestant world, the fact that your family, you may come from a Methodist family, moving over to one of the other mainline Protestant groups is not really a big transition. People will pick their church based on their needs, more so than denomination. But when there's only one synagogue in town, we don't have that opportunity. So that's an added challenge. When at the Passover Seder, which essentially is the retelling of the story of liberation from slavery in Egypt, when I make a contemporary by bringing in contemporary examples of how the same thing is going on, there'll always be people who object. Some people say, you know, if you don't make a contemporary, what good is it? And others who say, you make a contemporary, you totally deviated from its purpose. And sometimes you just have to bite the bullet and do what you think is right. And other times, and there's always a price to pay for that. It's a little easier among Christian clergy who have a more self-selected group that they're in the first place. But overwhelmingly, we all face the same challenges of rising secularism, religion having a bad name, owing largely to right-wing religion, which the press tends to associate when they use the word religion. They're usually talking about right-wing religion. You know, this idea that religion causes all the strife without ever, and it does sometimes cause strife. But on balance, historically, the good it's done is 10 times more important than the strife it's caused. Well, the problem really is reporting. I'll give you an example, but I can give you 100. 2 years ago, the World Parliament of Religions met in Salt Lake City. And there were approximately 10,000 religious leaders from 80 different denominations and groups. Because it was so close to Bozeman, we had a big delegation. It was an amazing love fest of all these religious leaders from every kind of conceivable, some kind of religions I'd never even heard of, about working together for peace and love and compassion and truth and so on. It got almost no press coverage. But while it was happening, some ISIS terrorist planted a bomb in a market and killed 3 people. And that was headlines. So let's see. Muslim terrorist kills 3 people. Headlines. 10,000 religious leaders gather to promote peace and love and harmony. Nothing. In December of this year, I'll be going to Nogales, Mexico, with 10 rabbis to work with a Jesuit institution that's based there, helping immigrants who are deported from the United States. When the United States deports a Mexican, they put them on a bus and they dump them in Nogales, just south of the border. Oftentimes with nothing but the shirt on their back. And they may come from a city that's thousands of miles away. And they have nothing. And their families are often back in the United States. So the Jesuits have set up some infrastructure to help these people. As I said, 10 rabbis will be going down this particular delegation to work with them to help these people. There's no press coverage going to come from that. Right? What's the press coverage? That, about how religious groups, certain religious groups, support our president's policies on immigration. Right? But that has some shock value. The problem with the media is that it's an industry and it's all about clicks and advertising dollars. Not your station, of course. I get it. I mean, but that's what happens. And somehow we forget that Moses, our foundational prophet, became important because he stood up to Pharaoh, who was the government of Egypt, the head of the government, and said, "No, let my people go." And eventually won. And we celebrate that. We celebrate that we were immigrants who fled slavery. Jesus comes along and stands up to the oppressive Roman government and says, "We won't stand for it." And of course, they ultimately execute him. But tending to the needs of people in the face of one of the most brutal oppressions in history by the Romans. Martin Luther King comes along and stands up to a government in the United States that allowed for segregation of people based on the color of their skin. Mahatma Gandhi, Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama. And these are just the names that sort of get that everybody knows. The 10 rabbis who go to Nogales, nobody will know their names. And that's okay. I'm not looking for that. But that's what I say, 100 times more good is done in the name of religion than the strife that it causes. It's just the way it's reported. I'll never forget how my daughter came back from history class in high school. She hated it because she said, "It seems like the study of wars. There's so much more happening in history than wars. But we've focused on wars so much, and there's so many people doing so much good." It's why I love to read the obituaries every day, because I find out about all these people who've done these fantastic good things in their lives. but never get noticed until their obituary for some reason. But if they do a bad thing, that'll be noticed. So in the 15th and 16th century, a bunch of Jews emigrate from Spain following the Spanish Inquisition to northern Israel, gravitating to a town called Sfat. And this mystical they're trying to cope with the pain of having been expelled from a country and losing all their possessions. And how can they explain that theologically? How can they explain that consistent with their belief in a just and compassionate God? And they come up with a theology. It's not made of whole cloth, but it's based on earlier stuff, or earlier Jewish writings. This notion that at the time of creation, there are some of the sparks in the creative process are too hot to handle, so to speak, and they go awry. All over, there are these clumps of creation that have gone awry, even though the great bulk of creation is good and beneficial. And that our job is tikkun olam, to repair the world, that is, to collect and these sparks that have gone awry and return them to their source, to make the world whole, as God's, and that humans play a big role in this. So some religious traditions, some brands of Christianity in particular, talk about grace, and that it's all God's grace, that we have no power in the process, that humans are just subject to God's will and grace. And Tikkun Olam is one of the Jewish doctrines that says that's not so, that we play a big role in the process, that yes, ultimately God is the more powerful partner, but that we're definitely partners. And the partnership, a big part of the partnership, involves this notion of repairing the world and moving it forward in the continuum as it evolves towards a more perfect world. That the basic forces for evolution are built into the universe, but needs our help. So, you know, unlike some sects and some religious groups that think the messianic times are upon us or coming, or that is a nice idea, but really there's always a struggle, and will always be a struggle to make the world slightly better in your lifetime. And you hope that you've, at the end, done that in some small way, knowing that it's only a few people will get written up in the history books, like Moses or Jesus or Martin Luther King, but that we each have the ability to make some small impact along the way towards moving the world towards this repair that it needs. And whatever impact we're capable of making, that's why we're here. A deeper understanding of Judaism understands that it's possible, in fact, desirable, to be particularist. In other words, to support what it means to support the Jewish faith and traditions, and at the same time be universalist. At the same time, understand that we are but an organ and a body. The body is the Gaia, the earth, maybe even beyond the universe. And that for a long time we thought that our chief concern had to be the health of the organ, that our own health, especially when we were under threat for so long from other organs. And now we understand, though, that our organ, the strength of our organ, is what keeps the body alive and all the other organs. And we have to learn how to go to the other organs and say, hey, you Buddhists, you know, you've really perfected this art of meditation, of chanting and meditation. Teach it to us. And they need to come to us and say, hey, you Jews, you really understand what it means to have the Sabbath, where one day a week you stop creating and just be, get off the treadmill occasionally. Teach that to us. And you Christians who say that that God loves us so much that he's willing to lose his only son. Now, I'm not talking about now history. I'm talking about ideas. Teach us about that kind of love. That's a very deep love. That's an almost unfathomable love. And you Muslims who get down on your bellies to pray, teach us about that kind of humility, that kind of surrender. And instead of being in competition with one another and seeing the other as a threat, let's make Judaism strong so that Judaism can teach what it's perfected to the rest of the traditions and each one of the others the same, because we're all there in the end for the benefit of the Gaia, the body, the whole thing. And things really shifted, I think, in the last century in religious thought to understand that, that we're not, that in supporting the particular, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the real challenge is to support the universe and that we play a role in that. And by keeping if the kidneys and the liver and the heart are not strong, the body dies. But it's the body that's our ultimate concern. And yet, if we don't have strong organs, you can't support the body. And each of these organs has learned a particular way of being in the world that is all of which is needed. On the one hand, I've learned that strengthening the Judaism and teaching it and allowing people to understand the depths of what it has to offer has both an internal and an external component. You know, internal in you're supporting the organ, external in that ultimately that supports the body. And that's the work that I think has led to being, kind of a community rabbi here in many ways. And all the interfaith work I do, which is aimed ultimately at sharing what we've all learned and finding how to love one another through our differences, and respect one another through our differences, that is what I think about all the time. Israel is a political entity. It is a country like any other. And when it comes to the Palestinian issue, Israel has become, in my view, a bad actor. It has nothing to do with Judaism. Yes, Israel is considered the homeland to the Jewish people, but it has about as much to do with Judaism as Trump does with Christianity. It's a political entity. I think it goes against virtually every Jewish tradition in the Bible. And in its, as it relates to its role with the Palestinians. It's complicated by the fact that a lot of facts. First of all, beginning with the Holocaust and the need to have a place where Jews feel safe. As the former leader of the Israeli Knesset, the Congress, Avram Berg once said, it's as if we jumped out of a burning building and we landed on somebody else. So yes, you jump out of a burning building, but sometimes you land on somebody else. That can happen. It doesn't make you wrong jumping out of the building. But then at some point you have to figure out, okay, we landed on somebody else. What are we going to do about that? And at first the somebody else was extremely hostile and started wars. But along the way, that's shifted. And too many people now still think like they want to push us into the sea and this kind of thing. And it's no longer the case, at least mostly. Yeah, there are some radical groups like that, like Hamas. But mostly, ever since in the last 30 or 40 years, the failure to make peace is largely on Israel's, in my view, not a lot of people disagree with me on this, is largely on Israel's plate. I mean, Israel is a world power with the third or fourth strongest military. It's a David and Goliath situation. Of course, what's happened in the last decade or so is the same right-wing phenomenon that's happening all over the world. It's in Hungary, it's in Poland, it's in Italy, it's in France, it's in Sweden, it's in Finland, and it's in the United States. This hostility towards the other. And worse than the hostility towards the other is how smart politicians have leveraged that into consolidating their own power. In many ways, Israel is the canary in the coal mine for the Trump administration. Netanyahu is just like Trump, and he knows how to manipulate, like all politicians, but the particular he's a far right winger who galvanizes support partly by hate of another group. And it's a little easier because in most people's recollection, there was good reason to hate this other group. You know, now there are regular attacks by his settlers on Palestinians, much more so than the other way around, in the West Bank anyway. If you air this and their people are listening, it will probably bar me from entering Israel again. Because now speaking against Israel has become, if not criminal, they're stopping people at the border and not letting them in. Rabbis who have spoken publicly against Israel. And this idea of stamping out dissent, which the right wing is a feature of right wing governments and authoritarian governments. And you've got Steve Bannon over there spending most of his time in Europe now, encouraging these right wing governments and trying to destroy the European Union. And I frankly fear those forces that caused Hitler to rise to power are happening again. But the irony, the deep irony, is that Israel is one of those forces this time. And it's not only with respect to Palestinians, but just the authoritarian rule in general. And I haven't brought myself yet to join the Boycott Israel movement, as many rabbis have. But nor can I stand by idly and say nothing in the face of what I consider a desecration of Judaism. There's a part of me that says I ought to be joining the boycott, just sort of like what we did in South Africa. But once you do that, you then take yourself out of the conversation. you're no longer, instead of being on the left, you might say, within the conversation, you're then not part of the conversation. You know, I could make the same argument about why haven't Americans boycotted America, you know, those who oppose Trump and his administration. You know, do you stay? This is always a tricky ethical problem. When horrible things are going on, do you try to stay part of the conversation, or do you leave the conversation? And I'm still trying to stay part of the conversation. I do have some pieces of boycott in me. For example, I won't knowingly buy any products or drink any wine that comes from any occupied territory, which would include the Israeli settlements on the West Bank. I mean, Palestinian territories are not really producing anything to buy, but that's different than boycotting Israel proper. And the only product I know of, therefore, is Israeli wine that's produced on the West Bank. And I certainly won't use it in religious ceremonies. It's a small thing, but it's a tricky. The whole thing is very, very tricky. And we're not that far removed from 1945, where the country of Israel, just a few years later, became a safe place for a people that has not had a safe place in 2,000 years. And even though it's become rather despicable in so many ways, I can't ignore that need for a safe place after 2,000 years of history when there was none. And to totally turn my back on it, as awful as it's become, can't go there yet. You know, a lot of people have dropped out of the political process in America because they just feel it's totally dominated by certain groups and we're powerless. I get it that people feel that way, but I'm not dropping out. And no matter what, no matter how bad it gets, I'm going to continue to be part of the voice. And so when you drop out, you know, there's a price to be paid.
I figured the best way to end this episode was with dessert. Here's a sweet little interview that guest reporter Melissa Leverage did for us last summer with the owner of Granny's Donuts.
Well, it's a awesome, long, strange trip, as a Grateful Dead would say.
Robert McWilliams is the owner of Granny's Donuts, the donut shop that is virtually on top of Montana State University in Bozeman.
Everybody calls me the donut guy. I own Granny's Gourmet Donuts here in Bozeman. I've made donuts about 16 years, made over a million donuts, some of them good.
Robert's identical twin brother, Billy, owns Erotique, the downtown adult novelty store.
So we're identical twins. We're both Eagle Scouts. We were born in Texas, and we lived all over the world because my father was in the Air Force. We came to Bozeman in 1978, looking very thin, with very bad haircut and polyester clothes, and then we've been here 40 years.
The two are something like local legends in Bozeman.
We like Bozeman.
Yeah, definitely.
We feel like we fit in. We try to contribute to the community. We have a lot of fun.
Robert had never owned or worked in a donut shop until he opened Granny 16 years ago.
I decided about 16 years ago that Bozeman needed a donut shop, so I bought the equipment in Calgary, used equipment in Calgary, shipped it down here, and installed a donut shop here, and then I had to learn how to work the equipment. So that took me a couple of years, because it's not easy. I've never worked in a donut shop except this one, so I hope I'm doing it right. I've shipped donuts all over the country. I've shipped donuts to Vienna, Austria, and I've shipped donuts all over the country to people that like the donuts.
Granny's Donuts has got a pretty prime location right next to the Montana State University campus and next to Jimmy John's, the sandwich shop, and Mellow Mood.
Yes, we get the afternoon stoner rush, which is really funny because I think stoners don't think that, you know, we know that we don't have a nose and we can't smell or we can't see their eyeballs. So it's kind of fun to play with them. But, you know, hey, it's a big world. I hope they have fun, too.
We asked Robert if he had any wild or weird Bozeman stories that he'd like to share, and he sure did.
Yeah, well, one time I was taking the garbage out because, you know, I have such a glamorous life, and I looked in the dumpster. There was a backpack, so I thought, well, heck, that looks like a good backpack, and I'm not shy about dumpster diving. So I took the backpack out of the dumpster and opened it, and there was a laptop. I'm like, wow, there's a nice laptop. So I took it back to the kitchen here, and I opened it up and started running it, and it was a really nice laptop. So I called up my brother and said, Billy, I found this laptop. He goes, whose is it? And I says, I don't know. It's this guy's name is Jason Cody Wright. And he said, oh, okay. I said, okay. And then he calls me about 2 minutes later and says, Robert, he's the dead guy. And there was a murder. Yeah, I know. It's a horrible story. There was a guy that got murdered. His name was Jason Cody Wright. He got murdered on Huffine Lane there. It was a bad drug deal gone bad. And it was horrible for Bozeman because we don't get those kind of murders. And the guy that had committed, one of the guys that committed the murder lived about, you know, 50 yards from the dumpster, and he had just taken the laptop and threw the laptop in the dumpster. So I got on the phone and I called. I got really kind of trembly because I'm like, man, that's right, I got a dead guy's laptop. So I got on the phone and I called up the sheriff's office because I knew it's the detectives. They said sheriff's office. I go, hi, this is Robert at Granny's Gourmet Donuts. And they go, oh, we love your donuts. And I'm like, okay, yeah, well, good. I found the dead guy's laptop. She goes, no. I go, yeah, I found the dead guy's laptop in the dumpster. She says, well, don't touch it. Well, I had touched every part of it. But I said, oh, okay. So all the police officers came by, and they cordoned off the dumpster, and in the trash that was a birthday card from his mother that had the guy's name and address, again, 50 yards from the dumpster, and the murderer's name was on it. And there's four cop cars parked in front of Granny's. I badly wanted to go outside and take a picture of all the cop cars and my donut shop sign because I figured that'd be great advertising. But I was kind of freaked out.
I'm
still freaked out over that. Yeah, was over definitely. 10 years ago.
Robert said he and his brother love Bozeman and that their main goals are truly just to make it a better and happier place.
We try to make it a good experience. We try to make this place a happy, happy place, because God knows we need happy places.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's kind of what Billy and I do. We make people happy. We might use different avenues to make them happy. vastly different avenues to make people happy, but we do make them happy, and that's kind of our goal.
For KGVM Community Radio, this is Melissa Loveridge.
Well, guys, that wraps it up for this episode of Ear to the Ground. We hope you enjoyed the three interviews that you heard today. Every episode of Ear to the Ground can be found at www.kgvm.org. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it. Hope you have a good day. Rachel Leith, signing off for KGVM Bozeman. Just a quick side note, the views and opinions expressed on this show are in no way reflective of the views and opinions of KGVM, its staff, and its board. Girl, you still have my laptop, and you still owe me dough. I paid 3/4 of the rent, you gave me nothing but grief. You need to get out my life, yeah, I need some relief. Don't like the way you look at me, I've had enough. Don't like the issue you're texting me, calling me up. Don't like the things you said to me, all of your lies. You'll never get me back, no matter how hard you try. Because I'm single and I'm famous, all these people know what my name is. While I'm touring the world, you're eating at Mickey D's. You should refresh in your roommates, I'm always celebrities. I trashed your love letters, took you out of my phone. Boy, when you call my cell, all I see is unknown. I waited 6 whole months while you went to Japan. Now you're turning on the radio and hearing this jam. Don't like the tone you take with me.